coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation. It's your host, Doug Hagman.
This is the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. If it looks a little bit different today, it kind of is. We have a very special in-studio guest with us. Derek the Tech did a lot of work behind the scenes to get this to look right. Hopefully it does. I think it does. Jack Cashel, Cashel.com, has a new book out about about Barack Hussein Obama. It's titled Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply, and How... You know, how timely is this? So Jack Cashel is with me. Folks, visit and bookmark HagmanReport.com. That's HagmanReport.com, two ends on Hagman, for all of the video audio assets there. And click on the banner on top, and it'll take you to our video page, and you can watch this in streaming living color. That's right, HagmanReport.com as well for all print articles and such. And HagmanStore.com for various items, including but not limited to... And thank you for making this book popular, In the Dark of Night. It's holding at a 4.9 rating, 65 reviews or something like that, and reviews, whatever. And it's doing well. It's available in paperback and Kindle. And, of course, HagmanStore.com, the same thing. So I appreciate all of you. And if you did get it through HagmanStore.com, stop by Amazon and leave a rating, an honest review. If you don't mind. All right. Again, as I said, with me, folks, is really a good friend of the show, good friend of mine, and an absolutely astounding, investigative journalist, Jack Cashel. He's an independent writer, documentary producer and media consultant. Jack's written for Fortune, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Weekly Standard, American Thinker, WorldNet Daily, American Spectator. Do you want me to go on? I could go on. He's published a few books. How about 15 under his own name and collaborated discreetly on 20 others. That's in his spare time. Okay. He's produced a score of documentaries for regional PBS and national cable channels. He's got a PhD from Purdue University in American Studies. Just like me. I've got two PhDs. No, I don't. So I should call him Dr. Jack Cashel, but anyway, he's taught media and literature at Purdue and Kansas City Area University and served as a Fulbright lecturer in France. We're just talking about France right before the on-air. And, you know, my introduction, I got to look over there, right? Thank you, Eric. My introduction to Jack was this book right here, which Jack reminded me is the 25th anniversary this year of TWA 800, 25 years, hard to believe. This introduced me to Jack, his tremendous investigative research and reporting on that. And then, of course, got to show you this, because this is part of the I don't know if this is part one, but this is a part of what we're going to be talking about today. This is Unmasking Obama. I want to make sure I had the right one there. And check this out. This is kind of my personal favorite. This is The Hunt. And this is about a father taking his two teenage sons elk hunting in Colorado, only to discover that they're the ones being hunted. This is a great book. And with that, I'm just going to tell you to go to Cashel.com and check out his new work. Jack, how are you, sir? I appreciate you coming in.
Doug, I am thrilled to be here. I always enjoy this. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, we always hook up with my old traveling mates here, and they're here with us.
That's right. I want to give a shout out. We actually have a studio, a vast studio audience, as we look out over. Susan Daniels, a remarkable private investigator from Ohio. In fact, she was the one, Susan Daniels was the one that really initially blew the lid off of the Obama long-form birth certificate eligibility, more appropriately. And then Mr. Nin Privatera, good friend of the show, good friend of the program, just a great guy altogether. Appreciate him. And of course, as I said, Jack. So, and Eric's at the helm. So, anyway, Jack, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to come here in studio today. So, I want to ask you, you've got a new book that's coming out when?
July 6th. This is the one up on the screen here.
Okay.
Barack Obama's Promised Land, the Deplorables Need Not Apply.
Check it out, folks.
Nin and I were driving down here today. I have a summer place about an hour north of here on Lake Erie. And about halfway here, and Nin will attest to this, I said, I forgot the book. I had a special copy for you. I got an advance copy. I was going to give it to you on the show. But I'll have to send it to you. But it actually looks real good. I love the cover. And
you know what? I'll follow you back there. And okay, just to make sure. You know, I'll walk you down to the lobby. No, I'll follow you back there. I can't wait. I just can't wait to read it. So when's it coming out again?
July 6th.
All right. Let me write this down.
Yeah.
Okay, July 6th. And you can pre-order the book now, right?
Yes. On wherever you pre-order books, Amazon, right. Barnes & Noble, whatever. Amazon is the way they keep score now, which is, it's unfortunate because I don't like to give Amazon any more money than I need to, but if you're an author, that's the scorecard now.
Right.
That's the only scorecard. The bookstores are, especially for conservative authors, have become fairly irrelevant. If they stack your books at all, they'll put it someplace where no one can find it.
Yep.
And it's just the way they do it. So, you know, I know I don't want to encourage people to go to Amazon, but for my sake, go to Amazon.
Well, you know, yeah. I understand that. And it's a good way to get the word out, at least in my view. It's a good way to get the word out, that ordinarily people would not be able to get. So now, although I've got some keen insight here, I'm going to ask you, tell me what Barack Obama's name of the book, Promised Land, Barack Obama, Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply. Tell me, what's this book about?
Well, you know, in November of 2020, Barack Obama came out with his long-awaited memoir. I mean, this is the memoir that includes the presidency.
Right.
And the years leading up to the presidency, 750 pages. He put a lot of time and effort into it. It wasn't like his previous books, which were either one was just dashed off or as a campaign book, that's Audacity of Hope, and the other one, a 1995 book, which is, I pointed out in 2008, was largely doctored by Bill Ayers, his terrorist pal.
Mm.
This book in The Promised Land, he has the time and the energy and the effort to get into it. I hadn't intended to write this book, but I was going to write a book review. And I looked at the other reviews of Obama's memoir, and I realized that the reviewers, New York Times, Washington Post, you know, all the big places, had no idea about his presidency. So they had no idea whether he was telling the truth. They had no idea what was in there and what was not in there. And then it dawned on me that fake news was on the verge of becoming fake history.
Ooh.
And then it dawned on me that I was the only one who could intervene. You know, I was the only one who could straighten the record out. Now, that's not to say that the New York Times will pay any attention to it, but historians have to, because they know I know what's not in the book. They know that I know the stories that he hasn't told. They know that I also know why his presidency was the total failure it was in the way that all of us wanted him to succeed. And that is, even those of us who didn't vote for him, and that's, I think, everyone in the room, our whole studio audience here.
That's right.
We wanted him to succeed at one thing, and that was pulling the races together.
Right.
I mean, no one that I know, you know, I don't know any white supremacists personally, although now the nation's filled with them. I've spoken to Republican groups from one end of the country to the other, and I've never met a white supremacist in the wild in his natural habitat. Maybe they exist. I don't know. But they exist on the pages of the New York Times. That word wasn't even used as recently as 3 years ago.
Right.
Or white nationalist. If you look at word usage in New York Times, and this is easy to do, you go online and look, put in a word and they'll tell you its usage over time in New York Times. Racism. Choom.
Yeah.
White supremacy. Choom. You know? White nationalist. Choom. You know? Just in the last few years, all courtesy of our racial healer, Barack Obama. And what's tragic about it is that he had the potential to live up to the one major promise he made, and that is he made it at convention speeches 2004 and 2008. There's not a white American, a black America. There's not a red state America, a blue state America. There's one America, the United States of America. And even, as I say, even those of us, and I suspect you can confirm this in your case, wanted him to succeed in that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you'd have to, I mean, who wouldn't want him to succeed? It would be crazy. Not, I mean, I understand that. But look at, okay, so, and I guess this is where I have trouble at this point. Most people consider him to be African American, right? I mean, would you agree with that?
Right. Yes.
All right. So
I should say, let me say this, in his book.
Yeah.
He never once refers to himself as biracial.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Let alone white.
Yeah.
Even though he grew up in a white household with white parents, grandparents, right, et cetera, you know.
So here we are in 2021, and everyone who is not a person of color apparently is a white supremacist. So I guess how does that happen after 8 years of what one would consider an African-American president?
Well, you know, and it didn't happen. It didn't have to happen. And we were talking off the air about a hot mic experience. I'm going to tell you one, the one that shaped the Obama presidency. And this one, of course, he does not talk about in his book, unfortunately. So I fill in the gaps of what's in his book, Promised Land.
Okay.
I fill in the gaps that should be there but aren't. I tell the stories that he should have told but didn't.
So wait a second, just so I'm clear. Your book, Promised Land, is taking Obama's memoirs and correcting the record?
That's it. Exactly right.
Okay. All right.
And I do it in a way that's amusing and colorful and, you know.
Sure.
And add stuff that, you know, he wouldn't think they had.
Yeah.
But I start off in the book, and which I thought was the best speech of Obama's ascendancy. This was in Father's Day. It was just this past weekend. I used to watch the U.S. Open all day, hoping to find an ad in which a white male was doing something that wasn't stupid, but that didn't happen. He gives a speech at the Apostolic Church in Chicago on Father's Day. He gives the kind of speech that everyone in this room would have applauded. Everyone of your viewers would have applauded.
Sure.
He starts off saying, you know, let's face it. You know, it's interesting, too, of course, is that if you're on the left, you can give speeches, political speeches in churches without arousing, you know, anxiety about church-state separation. But he starts off, he says, on a Father's Day, he goes, let's be honest, the real problem in our community is the fathers failing to live up to the responsibilities. These are men acting like boys, abandoning their children, leaving their homes. And then he goes through a list of statistics. He goes, here's what happens in fatherless homes. And these aren't the exact numbers, but they're close. Of boys who grew up without fathers are 10 times more likely to end up in prison, 15 times more likely to drop out of school, 20 times more likely to commit crime. He goes through the whole list. And he says, this is the problem in our community, right? And that speech did not get a lot of attention in the media. I got some, you know, the major media didn't quite know what to make of it because he's giving a message that Alan Keyes could have given, who was this, you know, ran against him. And when he ran for the Senate in 2004, or that, you know, that Sean Hannity could have given, or whomever. But it got Jesse Jackson's attention because Barack Obama had come into Jesse Jackson's hometown, south side of Chicago. And as you remember from his days as Clinton's spiritual aide during the days of impeachment, he came to the White House with his pregnant girlfriend or whatever. So he was the most prominent baby daddy in all of Chicago. And he did not like what Obama was saying about faith-based initiatives and fatherhood. So 3 weeks afterwards, this is not in Obama's book. It's in my book.
Right.
He gets on he's on a hot mic, right?
Mm.
And Doug and I were talking about off the air that a lot of hot mic experiences are not accidental. You know, the people know that this is going to be picked up. And Jesse Jackson's in a hot mic in a Fox studio where he knows it could be leaked, right? And there's another black guest on, and they're talking off the air. And he says, Barack, he'd been talking down, you know, and he's talking in, you know, kind of a slangy kind of, you know, colloquial style to them N-words, except Jesse Jackson, of course, doesn't say N-words.
Right.
He says the word. He's allowed to. We're not. And I won't even say it on the air to quote what Jesse Jackson said for fear of getting Doug forever banned from the airwaves. He says, and then he goes this. He goes, and he makes a motion. He goes, he's talking to him, and we're blah, 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 blah. He goes, I want to cut his nuts out, right? And
he makes
a slashing motion with his hand. You know, he grew up in a rural South. He probably knows something about this, you know. Now, Barack Obama got the message. The media didn't want to talk about this. No one wanted to talk about this. He doesn't talk about it in his book. But Barack Obama got the message. And never again did he talk about fatherhood in any meaningful way for the next 8 years. So in 2008, it was possible for him to address the issue that's destroyed the black culture in America. We all know it. They know it. Everyone knows it. No one wants to talk about it. Obama was the one person who could have talked about it, and he got scared out of it because he's been scared all of his life of authentic African Americans. And, you know, he's been called out on this a few times. When he ran for Congress in 2000,
yeah,
they just made fun of him. He's not a real black guy. He's, you know, he's from Hawaii, you know. and then Cornel West, this crazy Princeton philosopher, black nationalist, he said it. He comes right out and said it. He's afraid of black men. You know, he doesn't know these people. He never grew up with them. He doesn't know them. You know, what he knew about black culture growing up in the least black state of America in a white household was what he saw on like Mod Squad or, you know, I mean, he didn't know. And can imagine how frightening that would be though, Doug. You come to Los Angeles as an 18-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I can.
And you look like these people, kind of.
Yeah.
But their culture is totally alien to you, you know? And it had to be a very, existential moment where he had to figure out literally who he was, and he never quite did.
That's pretty well stated, too. He had to figure out who he was, but never quite did. And I think that's a key to a lot of things. Oh boy, we could take that in a number of different directions. Interesting. Yeah, hot mic moment defining Barack Obama. Folks, Jack Cashel, cashel.com. That's C-A-S-H, Cash, I-L-L.
Right.
Yeah, cashel.com. His new book coming out available on July 6th. Barack Obama's Promised Land. Deplorables Need Not Apply. Of course, that's, filling in the blanks where Barack's promised land left or didn't what it didn't include. There it is on Amazon on your screen right now, folks. You go to Amazon, pre-order it, get it, get in line, so to speak, and be the first to get yours on the when it's available on July 6th, which is just a couple of weeks from now or a week and a half from now. So right. please do it now. I guarantee you, just from the peaks and looks and a little bit of advanced information I've got, which, you know what, is enough to really tell me that this is going to really make some waves in the political landscape, I believe.
Right. It's a great beach read, too. So when your audience, you all have $12 million beachfront estates in Martha's Vineyard, right? I mean, you could go to your beach.
Yeah.
Right.
Just like
Barack Obama does. John Kerry does.
Yeah.
They're not worried about climate change. They're not worried about income inequality. But wherever your beach is, and the beach I go to is Seaside Heights, New Jersey, I mean, so, which is where you don't have, the whole town isn't worth $12 million, let alone a given home. But you can read
our apologies to listeners there.
Nice beaches in New Jersey, I will say. So.
Well, yeah, I've never been to a beach in New Jersey. I've been to, but you know, it's pretty profound, what Obama said about, about fatherhood, because what we're seeing in, for example, in Chicago, anytime there's violence, it's brought up about the, how many fatherless homes and how many absentee fathers, the violence is a consequence of rudderless fatherless homes.
Yes.
So, you know, it's important. And so to have Jesse Jackson come in and say, you know, slices. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he used the word nuts, and I mean, that's, I think I could say that.
Can, of course. And he made, I said worse.
He made the slashing motion, which frightened me just watching it in replay.
Yeah. Ow. Okay. Yeah. Jeez. So, okay. You know, one of the things, and I don't want to jump around here, but if you permit me to ask you this,
sure.
Here we are in 2021. We've got Mr. Marbles in the White House, in my view. Okay. You know, Mr. Potato Head. And again, we can come back to this or we can go into something else. But my question is, are we looking at an Obama 2.0 presidency here, or what do we look? I mean, I feel like everything's upside down backwards, and I'm looking through a glass darkly in this whole
thing. That's an excellent question. And it's a question that comes up all the time. And I think it's what makes the book relevant, because here's what we know.
Yep.
We know who's not running the White House, right?
Yeah.
We know it's not the president, and we know it's not the vice president.
Right.
One of whom is, you know, it's hard to, I mean, if they had an incompetence contest, it would be hard to say who would be the winner. I mean, Kamala would have age on her side. You know, she's younger, but it'd be a tough call. And the irony is that Democrats don't want either one of them in there. They're embarrassed by both of them. They won't say that on the air.
Right.
So it has left an opening for Obama. Now, whether he is running the show, he thinks he's running the show. And he said as much. And he said, he did an interview a few weeks ago. He's been pushing himself up to the surface again, which is, you know, for next president, much more aggressively than usual, which for me is good because he makes it newsworthy. He makes himself newsworthy. But he said that, yeah, this is just a continuation of his presidency. And the book, which is amazing about the book, is that all the programs that you and I think of as failures, you know, including Obamacare, the stimulus, Dodd-Frank, monster, Frankenstein's monster, he sees as either successes or triumphs.
Wow.
I mean, he used the word triumph with Dodd-Frank, which even, you know, I mean, I talked to Bloomberg, though, is an utter disaster. Anyone in the financial industry, though, is a disaster.
Right.
It just overregulated industry in ways that were totally unproductive and hurt the small guy, you know, especially local banks.
Yep.
Everything in the book is a triumph. And he wants to see his mission extended into the Biden presidency. And he believes it is. And he says that 90% of the people who work for him are now working for Biden.
Which is that? I mean, is that true, roughly?
That's what Obama says.
Right.
Now, I think that's an exaggeration. Maybe he's talking about his top people, but people like Susan Rice, who's up in there. But there's people behind the scenes that this should be the number one issue. And if I were a Washington correspondent,
yeah,
I'd be wanting to know who's running the show.
Yes, I would too. I do.
But they work under the illusion that Biden's running the show. I mean, they have to work under that illusion because it's major media now has become essentially a propaganda arm for the Democratic Party, and they don't even make any pretense anymore.
Right.
You know? So they can't even ask the question that you and I and many people out in even Democrats would be asking. Okay, who's running this? We know Biden's incapable. We know Kamala's incapable. And what's even more bizarre is that they're fighting each other, Kamala and Biden. And so that there's not even any unity in that incompetent White House. And the prime evidence of which is his assignment to her of being border czar.
That was so, I mean, yeah. I mean, if you don't mind, address that for a little bit, because she's never been to the border. And then when asked, you know, when you're going to go down there, or why haven't you been down there, and why haven't been to Europe? You know, I mean, it's just, okay, whatever, but, so was Biden's assignment to heels up Harris? Was that a punishment of some kind?
I think it was retaliation for her having called him out as a racist during the campaign. And, yeah. You know, and I know that Jill Biden was very upset about that. And, it's a hot potato. It's a boondoggle. Biden doesn't want to be associated with the border. Who would? It's a mess. So he assigns Kamala that, you know, it's his way of putting her in her place. And how does she respond? She says, you know, F you, buddy, not going to the border, you know, we're going to let it fester.
She's going to go to the root causes. the root. So we're going to go to
Honduras. Go to Central America and embarrass ourselves there.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
I thought when the highlights of the last 4 months of 5 months of his presidency was the Trump won signs in Guatemala.
Yeah, I saw that.
One thing to see them in Yankee Stadium is another thing to see them in Guatemala, you know.
And speaking of that, okay. Yeah, we've got a real problem in this country. I don't know how far down you want to go. By the way, folks, Jack Cashel, Cashel.com. His new book available on July 6th.
Right.
Look, pre-order it now. Yeah. All right. Be the first to get it now because I am actually going to bumper lock him all the way back to his place and, pick up my copy today.
I'll put it in the mail, by tomorrow.
Well, you don't want me to your place, right?
Yeah, I know. Come on up and check out the place. Nice
right.
weather. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Barack Obama's promised land, deplorables need not apply. There it is on your screen.
Right.
All right. So you gotta, folks, seriously, okay, you have to check this book out because, the author of TWA 800, Obama Unmasked. This is, or Unmasking Obama. This is probably the, would you call this like, I don't know, the ultimate, if you will, or not the ultimate, but
I'd say it's the most knowledgeable.
The most.
And I get into questions here that, that I can answer and that I, and without the advantage of not only his book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, which is a big memoir, but another book came out in 2017 with the paperback coming out in 2018, David Garrow's 1,100-page biography of Obama's early years.
Oh, yeah.
Garrow is Pulitzer Prize winner, civil rights historian,
yep.
and a bold guy. And he's no friend of Obama's. He comes at him from the left. But he goes back and exposes parts of his history and documents it that the major media didn't even want to know about. And he and I have communicated. We don't agree on a lot of things, but we agree on one thing at least, and that is that that Obama has been he's been playing a role all of his life that he doesn't know how to play. You know.
So, okay, I would add Garrow's book or his research not as intense as Susan Daniels the.
Right.
PI, but nonetheless.
And Susan, by the way, was the one who discovered the Connecticut Social Security card.
Yeah.
And they still haven't answered that question.
You know, what are we going to do about it?
And what's interesting is that the left, the major media won't even talk about it, period. It doesn't even surface.
Well, the right doesn't even want to talk about it.
Right, exactly. The right doesn't want to. I can talk to long stories about that. But on the left, on the blogging left, they acknowledge that, yes, he does have a Connecticut Social Security card. Yes, there is no real way to account for that. So Snopes, which is a tool of the left and disguising itself as a fact-checking service, says, it's an anomaly. I guess we'll just have to live with it, you know? Now, if you're a serious reporter and you've got an anomaly that you can answer, you could get a Pulitzer Prize in a world where Pulitzers mattered or were real for solving that. Why does he have a Connecticut Social Security number? As Susan will tell you, the only way you can get one is to have filed from Connecticut at that time.
That's, yes.
Now, they've changed a little since, but, and so what was he doing in Connecticut? You know, how did he happen to have that? Well, that's a mystery that will be left, for some new generation of reporters, because the current generation of journalists right now, is utterly and totally not biased. We're long beyond biased. We're into total corruption.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And this is a good, folks, this is the great thing about Jack's book. And if you've read his previous books, again, the way Jack Cashel approaches various things, investigations and issues like TWA 800 25 years ago.
July, right?
Yeah, that's right. Things like this, but his new book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply. Obviously, I mean, is there anything besides the obvious under deplorables need not apply? Is it just the in your face kind of, oh, look at that, you know, look at that cover, folks. Look at the, you know, look at the, my lifestyle. Is it anything more than that, or is there something?
Well, I think, you know, just as a basic theme line, is that, you know, Barack Obama ascends to the presidency uncriticized, unvetted. And and he's in many ways a wildly insecure guy, as we were talking about earlier, because his identity issues go real deep, including his sexual identity. And we can talk about that.
Ooh,
later as well.
Yes, yes.
I talk about that in the book. I talk about things other people won't talk about. And I don't talk about things unless I know I'm on solid ground. But in any case, he's, and this is the fascinating thing about his memoir, Promised Land, is that once he starts running for president, he runs into criticism. He's so unused to that, you know, because he didn't get almost none, because Republicans are so afraid of him because he's black and they want to be called racist. And the bête noire of his book, the woman who drives him totally crazy, and it's very revealing, because you and I wouldn't even have thought about it. You know who it is?
No.
Sarah Palin.
What?
Page after page is dedicated to Sarah Palin.
Why?
Because she was the first one. She was the designated hit girl during the campaign.
Okay.
And her attacks were so mild, you know, by any kind of presidential standard.
Yeah.
She'd accuse him of palling around with Bill Ayers, which you did, and of, you know, having an affiliation with Acorn, which he had, you know, and that kind of level of thing, you know. But she was criticizing him. And here's what bothered him even more. And it's interesting because I've only gone to one Republican convention in my life. It was the 2008 Republican convention in St. Paul. And she stole the show. You know, Sarah Palin stole the show. In fact, McCain was, you know, we all know John McCain. Those were on the right. And we know his story. But when he was flirting with picking Joe Lieberman as his running mate, who had been Al Gore's running mate just 8 years earlier.
Right.
I know, even though I had a guest pass to go to the convention, I wouldn't have gone. And Sarah went, you know, and Nin can account, okay, Nin, I'm going to tell my own story here because Nin's here to verify this. But we got together in probably in June of 2008. We went to lunch with a couple other guys. And we're talking about who's going to be McCain's VP pick. And I said, Sarah Palin. And then everyone else said, who's Sarah Palin? You know, and I explained why she was the perfect candidate. Now, she's got great ratings in Alaska. She's good looking. She's attractive. She's pro-life. She's got, you know, kids, you know, and she has a Down syndrome child. She's got, you know, outdoors. She's pro-gun. I mean, she's perfect. And then when, in fact, when she was picked, Nin calls me. I was going back to St. Paul is where I was heading. And it's in September 2008. And he goes, how did you know? I said, I didn't even know he was talking about. How did I know what? He said, he picked Sarah Palin. I said, oh, great. I said, that was great. Now, and so the convention was energized because she was the pick. Right. Then the inside Republican establishment has been attacking her ever since. But so when Obama sees her, and he talks about this openly in his memoir, he goes, she dazzled him, you know? And then she started attacking me. And then her ratings were higher than I was, than mine were. And it just, and then she unleashes, and this is what becomes the running theme of the book. This is why Deplorables Need Not Apply as a subtitle. She unleashes this dark force within the Republican Party, this dark, evil, white supremacist force. And then, of course, it culminates with Donald Trump coming out, you know. So you would jump from Sarah Palin to the Tea Party, which is totally demonized in the book,
right,
to Donald Trump,
right,
who absorbs from that point on all the blows that the opposition can offer. But Sarah Palin bothered him because she was so authentic. She was the real American, and he uses that in quotes. And then he describes how authentic she was, hockey mom, you know, five children, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he's the opposite of that. He's a shadow. He's a cipher. He's this like evanescent figure who just sort of shows up. You know, he's the turtle on the fence post, you know?
Wow.
Whereas Sarah Palin is the hare. I mean, she's running her own race, you know? And then it becomes throughout the book, this Manichaean worldview of the elite progressive, you know, which leads to the arugula story. I'll tell you in a second. world that he occupies versus the dark, sinister, shadowy world of people like Sarah Palin and, you know, sinister. And then, of course, then the big, everything they do is racist. He reads racism into every oppositional point that someone makes against them. This was the president who come into office promising unity and begins dividing from the moment he's in the White House or even before.
Okay. So is Obama behind the fomenting the racial divide in this country? I mean, is he, because again, the office that he held and what he has said, and I mean, I'm really trying to think of how we got where we are today.
And we're in a terrible place. You wouldn't have imagined this 10 years ago. No. We could be here where we are today, racially.
No.
Where it becomes, you know, I mean, I wrote an article about this in today's American Spectator about watching the U.S. Open on Sunday's Father's Day. They show it every day on Father's Day because it's designed for people like you and I.
Right.
It's designed for...
You mean white people.
It's designed for middle-class men.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of black golfers, and they watch it just as avidly. But they're more like us than they are like the people who are designing the TV commercials.
Right.
I documented 45 commercials. You know, because I when I watched the Masters, I saw these commercials because I don't watch any other network TV otherwise. But and this time I said, okay, I'll instead of just lazing around watching U.S. Open, I'll do some homework here. 45 commercials, only two of them show white men as something other than fools or clowns.
Wow.
And if you look at the commercials, women, especially women of color, are flying our airplanes, driving our trucks, you know, managing factories, doing the IT. Even Ford, are you crazy? Driving our F-150s? You know, come on, give us a break. At least give us some, put us in our natural habitat a little bit, you know? And the white men, when they appear, are figures of they're foolish, they're irresponsible, insubstantial. They need to be corrected by women, usually or men of color, you know, and that's where we are. And this is a nutty place to be. And we've seen the, you know, the parent rebellions at these CRT inspired town halls or school board meetings, and it's all on Obama. And the thing is, it didn't have to be because he's not that way by nature.
So what you're saying, and correct me if I'm inaccurate here, Obama is the an unwilling architect or unwitting architect of
he's a witting architect
of
I'll just give you one statistic that will tell you who is pulling the strings on this front, on the racial front during the Obama years. In 2000, and I'm going to make this a guessing game here, so I don't mean to embarrass you, but
no,
for your audience,
audience
can think, who's the answer? Give us the answer to this question. Who is it that made 72 official visits to the White House by 2015? 72 official visits. Rudy Giuliani came on the air and said this. All the fact checkers went ballistic. And then they said, well, he's kind of right. There were 72 official visits by this individual who I'm convinced... And he may seem like a clown to us, but was the kind of person that Obama is terrified of. Any answer?
Studio audience?
Al Sharpton. You got
there
it right.
There we go.
Al Sharpton.
See, notice how I pass that along.
Howdy doody time. But 72 official visits.
72? Okay.
Obama's afraid of these people. He allowed that fear to, and by the way, the person he's most afraid of in that world?
Yes.
Michelle Obama.
You know? Well.
She was the, you know, he marries, he's a pragmatic guy. He marries Michelle because she roots him into the black community.
Wait a second. What Jesse Jackson cut off, Michelle is holding in her purse, right?
That's well said. I'm going to steal that line, Doug.
Go ahead. Actually, I'm not sure if it's a purse or a hand.
Right. You know, got him by the, you know.
Man bag, whatever. But go ahead.
And she, you know, is his sounding board throughout, from before he was president. She was the one who kept whispering in his ear, they hate you. They hate you. They're all racist. This is all pretense. And it becomes so that he incorporates this into his new persona.
Right.
Now he's Mr. CRT, you know. He's not the Obama of 2004 at the convention, who was probably believed what he was saying, you know.
So he over the course that included his residency in the Oval Office because of his questionable eligibility. So he really became radicalized.
Certainly superficially. If he wanted to remain relevant in the Democratic Party, and he was its most prominent figurehead,
right,
and especially as a person of color, he had to go with this flow. If he fought this flow, he'd be Joe Manchin.
Ooh.
You know, one of those kind of marginalized people who are trying to please everyone.
Right. Right. And, yeah, we know what Joe Manchin did with a filibuster, right?
He's been useful. Let's face it. We're not going to have the HR1, which is thank God. And
right.
That's a major, major relief to many of us.
Yeah.
But that's who he'd be. He'd be this figure that the party left behind.
Okay. All right. I can see that. And folks, the book, again, Barack Obama, Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply. That's you and me. We don't need to apply. Yeah. Jack Heschel is the author. There it is on your screen. Go to Amazon and make sure you pre-order your copy. It's going to be available July 6, 2021. And get it in hard copy or Kindle form. And do it sooner rather than later. And I like the cover because it does.
It's cheerful.
It's cheerful.
It's a good summer read. I mean, you take it to your beach home, you know.
That's right. And kick the sand off. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So, and again, folks, what Jack does, I believe, is really. Would you say you dissect and correct?
Dissect and correct. That's what the book is. Because otherwise, as I mentioned, fake news becomes fake history.
Right.
So you already have historians like Douglas Brinkley saying, repeating the mantra of the last 8 years, I was a scandal-free presidency. And you and I look at each other and say, oh, yeah. Well, yeah, if you don't mention Fast and Furious, if you don't mention Benghazi, if you don't mention the IRS, suppression of the Tea Party, if you don't mention the Russia hoax, you know,
sure,
scandal-free. And so they don't mention it, and someone has to fill in the blanks, and that's me.
Yeah, and no better person to do it, especially the author of TWA 800, Unmasking Obama, and so many other books. What is it, 15 books or something? I don't know. But plus you're a writer for numerous publications. So it's an honor to have him in studio, folks. It's an honor to have Jack Heschel here with me. And I really do hope, and I'm going to drive this point home, I really do hope that you grab a copy. Get in line. Do it today. In fact, before this broadcast, or while this broadcast is on, just open a new tab and order your advanced copy of Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply. I guarantee you will not be disappointed.
One thing I do get into, and I think your audience will probably find interesting, I did, because I wanted to get this story straight, was the birth certificate.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because Susan Daniels, famous PI, is here.
Right, right.
And let's talk about this.
You know, and I had, let's face it, we can read 100 articles saying the birth certificate's a forgery, but we know that that argument's not going to win anyone beyond our immediate circle.
Right.
You know, it's odd because I work with an Islamic author this year as his editor on a book project, and who had left Islam. And he wanted, the reason he left, because it's a little bit of a digression, but he was an imam. He was the son of, he was the Franklin Graham of Egypt. His father was its leading Islamic figure.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an imam as an adolescent. And he wanted to take his English skills and so master Islam that he could take it to the West and convince people who were not of that tradition just how glorious it was. And then the deeper he dug into it, he realized the whole thing was empty, you know.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, in my case, what I wanted to be able to do was to take the birth certificate story out to the public, in a larger public, and say, there is reason to pay attention to this story. And I'm not going to be able to do it by saying, oh, here's, look at these documents here. It's layered over, you know, that, you know.
Right.
They may, all that stuff may be legitimate. It's just that it's, I can't sell it. It's unconvincing.
And folks, you remember, we had, Mike Zullo on, 9 points of forgery. We understand all of that. Okay. And I know you folks do too. So go ahead.
But what I can tell, and they do tell in the book, Barack Obama's Promised Land, is how and why the Barack Obama campaign and the DNC fought the release of his birth certificate. And it goes back to 2008, and the initial person to bring suit was, of course, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, Philip Berg,
right,
who was a Hillary supporter. But he did not do this at Hillary's behest because really his effort came after it was a done deal, after Obama had already sealed the nomination. That's when the oceans stopped to rise. Remember that?
Right.
And so he files suit, and he expects to be taken seriously. He had been the deputy attorney general in Pennsylvania, and he files a legitimate suit. He said, I want to see the birth certificate and the passport file. And he said, this is the first unvetted president. He goes, he needs to be vetted. That's the phrase he used, because mm-hmm. he wrote a subsequent book about it that I read and maybe three other people. And so he takes it. And what I wanted to track is how and who was involved in resisting this. So in 2008, the Obama campaign and the DNC hire a fellow named Bob Bauer, who's with the law firm Perkins Coie.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring a bell?
Mm-hmm.
Perkins Coie, by the way, would go on to hire CrowdStrike to investigate the DNC servers in 2016, because that wasn't a good, useful job for the FBI, right?
Right.
And CrowdStrike would decide, oh, these are Russian hackers.
There you go.
And yeah. Later that summer, or that same summer, Perkins Coie stepped up and hired Fusion GPS to create the Steele dossier, you know? when I saw Perkins Coie, I said, oh, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. This isn't just some, you know, small beer operation. This is major. They are taking this very seriously. So, and they've got, the judges are probably wired. So Berg takes his suit. He expects to be taken seriously. He's not. The media pay him no attention at all. And then about a year after the suit is brought in maybe November 2009, the judge dismisses it.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, Berg is an attorney. He's a little shocked by this because he thought the dismissal was, you know, totally arbitrary and wrong and political. And soon as it's dismissed, Bob Bauer, who is defending against the suit, is promoted to White House counsel.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, the day after. And the subsequent other suits are brought, and Perkins Coie fights them. There's a lot of money spent resisting this information. Then it's in 2011, and this is where Barack Obama's Promised Land becomes essentially most revealing, because it reminds me of the baptism scene in the end of The Godfather, you know, where, you know, Michael is the godfather to his godson, yeah. His nephew. And meanwhile, his guys are all whacking people, you know, so. You have all these coordinated events that come. Finally, with Donald Trump prodding, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. this is in May of 2011. Obama makes this big show of producing the birth certificate. What do? They send Bob Bauer, sends other Perkins Coie attorney, allegedly to Hawaii, to retrieve right. these two copies from the late Loretta Fuddy.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Yep.
And they come back, and, you know, they're like the trophy, we've got them.
Mm-hmm.
But certain other things are going on simultaneously. And this is where, in a sense, my book climaxes, because the Obama story, he only takes it up to the raid on Osama bin Laden. So he's doing that. meantime, his staff writers are producing these joke lines for Obama to take out Trump at the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner. This is all happening in a 3 or 4 day period. And at the same time,
wow,
his, you know, national security team is plotting the raid on Osama bin Laden.
Right, right.
And at the same time, Obama is meeting with Eric Holder because Eric Holder has to go before the Congress to talk about the White House's role in Fast and Furious. This is all going on in a 4 day sequence. And it's designed to make talk of the birth certificate seem almost blasphemous, which is what happened.
Exactly.
Because how dare you talk about the birth certificate for the man who just killed Osama bin Laden, right?
Right.
That story was totally phonied up. And I get into the details of how. It's kind of complicated, probably more than you need to hear right now. And then Eric Holder goes, and there's the news cycle is totally consumed with Osama bin Laden. Trump is seemingly humiliated. He wasn't. He gets the last laugh on this whole thing. And then Eric Holder gets in to sneak in with his utterly, fabricated account of the Fast and Furious' genesis before a nation that's paying zero attention. And so all the problems are solved. The Tartaglias are dead. All the other crime families are wounded, and Obama gets to keep on keeping on. It was probably the cleverest moment of his presidency when you had a media that was fully willing to play ball with you, and which is part of the problem, part of the issue. But he made a mistake. He thought by humiliating Trump, he would force him out of the arena.
Obviously
he didn't know Donald Trump.
Exactly. He did not know Donald Trump. In your book, and again, folks, if can we toss that on the screen up again, please? The book, of course, Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply. It's going to be available again, or it's going to be available on July 6th. Please, folks, go to Amazon. By the way, can they get that off of your website?
No. I mean, my website will take them to Amazon, so okay. I'm not selling right. through my website.
All right. That's fine. So, folks, order your copy today. As soon as this program is over, I guarantee you, I'll just be frank. I know what's in it, but I'm going to get the hard copy after I bumper lock Jack, on his way out of the studio today. So, it's going to be well worth your time. It's a good resource, good source of information about really where we are, how we got here, why we're here in a sense, because I like to ask these questions and, really the deconstruction of the promised land of Barack Obama. So it's really kind of it really fills in a lot of blanks. I'm going to ask you about your book in this respect. What do you think is the one piece of information in there that, would be a defining moment, I don't want to say defining for the book, but defining maybe for our nation and, or even Obama or subsequently Trump. I mean, is there something in that book that you could point to and say, man, that was the time or that was the period or that was the event that really kind of shaped or really pushed to shape things?
Well, you know, the one event that Obama makes a big case about in the book, and he talks about a lot more than I thought he would. And it intrigues me to see, you know, because I know the story so well, and I know what I would have put in there if I were telling an honest, honest story. His memoir is not honest at all, but
right.
And it is the moment I think that, and in his reflection on it, is what intrigues me. And it would seem like a trivial incident at the time, but in terms of shaping his presidency, it was kind of major. And that was the Henry Louis Gates incident. Henry Louis Gates was a Harvard professor.
The Beer Summit.
Yeah, right. The beer, which leads to the infamous Beer
right,
Summit.
Right.
And we're with Joe Biden drinking non-alcoholic beer. And the story was, it blew up in Obama. He didn't expect it to. So he's asked, what happens is that Henry Louis Gates is a professor at Harvard, black professor. And he comes in late, doesn't have his keys. He and his driver are essentially breaking into his own home through mm-hmm. the back door. A neighbor sees someone breaking into the his neighbor, her neighbor's home. She's demonized in all this too, by the way, as it turns out, and calls the police. Police guy comes out, and then Gates goes off on him, calls him, you know, could you please come outside? Your mama comes outside. You know, he's just cursing at him, causing a ruckus. A tumult is the word that the police officer used in the police report. Refused to come out, called him all kinds of racial names and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And then Obama's asked about this at a press conference. And he's, you know, and he goes on, he goes, well, here's what I can say is that, and I think he was prepared for the answer. I can say this, I haven't seen all the evidence, but I know the police acted stupidly, is what he said.
Yep.
And then he went on and said, given the long history of blah, 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 oppression, blah, 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 you know. And it blew up in his face. He didn't count on certain things. One is that the police officer in question was the guy who led the diversity training for the Cambridge, Massachusetts police. And his commission refused to apologize or back down, and neither did the cop. You know, we expect them, the you know, cops when accused to, oh, I'm sorry. Well, they didn't. And then in his memoirs, and what's interesting about the memoir, the Promised Land, the one that just came out, is that when he reflects back on how he responded, I responded just the way I thought I should have. I don't know why they thought I was wrong to respond the way I did. Of course, blah, 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 blacks have been blah, 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 and of course, blah, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was surprising because at the time, he seemed to be thrown off guard. He wasn't expecting this, which leads to this stupid beer summit with Joe Biden. Right. They invite the officer, Crowley, I believe his name is Crowley, and I've been watching too much Downton Abbey. I confused the two names. And everything seems to be smoothed over. But that was the beginning of the racialization of the presidency. When it became obvious, and Obama talks about this in his memoir, there was a them and an us. And he desperately wants to be part of the us. The us meaning Michelle. The us meaning Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton.
Oh, okay.
And, and he can't be because he's not part of the us.
Right.
Who he is the guy who gave us in 2007 Arugula-gate, which I talk about in the book.
No,
you may not remember Arugula-gate.
No.
I remember at the time having to look up the word arugula because I didn't know what it was.
Isn't that a leafy vegetable of some kind or what?
Well, we all know that courtesy of the Arugula-gate. But in 2007, Obama is on the campaign trail early in Iowa, right?
Uh-huh.
And they're talking about the high price of food. And they're probably talking about the high price of crops or something, you know. And Obama says to them, and he's quoted as saying this, he goes, yeah, he goes, can you believe the high price of arugula? I'm at a Whole Foods, how much they're charging now, right? He actually says this. And at that time, there was not a Whole Foods in the state of Iowa, you know. I mean, people are talking, what's arugula, you know? Well, it's arugula is a kind of vegetable they sell at Whole Foods and dilettantes like Obama eat, you know.
Right.
And it didn't blow up much. But he doesn't talk about that in the book. I do. Because when he talks about the people in San Francisco, you know, that he's fundraised, where he has to go for fundraisers,
right,
he talks about them as Prius driving, latte drinking, as though he were not one of them.
Oh.
But up to 2008, he was one of them.
Of course. Okay.
And then when he becomes gets involved in the Henry Gates incident, he realizes that now he's got to become one of us, the us being black African-Americans. He was caught in the middle. He was never one of us. He was one of them. He was the arugula eater. He was the latte Prius driver, you know? You know, literally, it's a sort of a crisis for him, an emotional crisis, because he's got to decide which side he's on. And so from then on, he has to start signaling black, 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 not we're one in one whole nation, one, you know, colorblind people. And then it becomes full square. And this is where everything spins out of control with the death of Trayvon Martin. And so Obama is being pressured by black radicals, and not even not so radicals, mm-hmm. the race people like Sharpton, Jackson, et cetera. And they're saying, why aren't you speaking out about the murder of Trayvon Martin? And so finally he comes out, he says, hey, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. That's what I know. I don't know all the facts of the case. He says, just like he says, but if you had a son, And from that moment on, he created the momentum. And one thing leads directly to another. So Black America is totally expecting George Zimmerman to be convicted. It's because they paid no attention to the details of the case.
Right.
George Zimmerman was spared, unlike Derek Chauvin. Zimmerman was spared because the jury was clueless. There were six women on the jury, none of them even, you know, I forget the name of the county in Florida that was semi-rural, small town. It was a jury that was objective. Six women on the jury.
Yeah.
And they voted to acquit. When they did, the day after the acquittal, you know what organization was formed because of the acquittal?
Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter. That's where it was born.
Give me a cookie.
Yeah.
All right.
And then 2 years later, of course, Black Lives Matter takes their show to Ferguson.
Right.
And they repeat the drama, this time with even more effect because they can direct it against the police.
Right.
Not a white Hispanic like George Zimmerman. And once that happens, the crime rates spike. This is the last 2 years of Obama's presidency. Murder rate goes through the roof. It goes up 9-10% each year and had been on a steady downward decline because the police are pulling back and the thugs are moving in and they seize the opportunity. And so Colin Kaepernick, you know, when he takes his knee,
mm-hmm.
It's the eighth year of the Obama presidency. You've had 8 years of a black attorney general. You've had 8 years in which Democrats are running every city in the country. And you're saying there are bodies in the street? Well, yeah, but who's putting them there? Colin? You know, and Colin was as confused as Barack Obama was because he was also half black. He also grew up in a white household. He was desperately searching for identity like Obama was. And you find that identity in identifying with your non-white half, you know, by over-identifying with that persona that has eluded you all your life, you know, and now you're desperate to root yourself in it. And Colin Kaepernick's decline is essentially mirrored by Obama's or vice versa, you know.
So identity politics and identity the way we have it today with, racial identity and identity. I mean, it was birthed by Obama, I suppose, or at least, how would you put it?
Not birthed by, but a renaissance.
There you go.
Renaissance is a positive word, but the negative equivalent of a renaissance.
Yeah. All right. I get that. Okay. Wow, man, this is, folks, Jack Cashel, in studio guest, very special day today. Of course, you know, we're doing the casual thing today. Jack Cashel, author of Barack Obama's Promised Land. It fills in the blanks where Obama, the things that Obama left out. You've got to get this book. And, you know, I love to read. I really do. And this is one of the books that, I'll tell you what, you will thank me. You will thank me later when you read this book. Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply to You and Me. It's available on Amazon and on
Noble.
Yeah,
Barnes & Noble. Probably be at your bookstores. You got to probably ask and look because they're, you know, they hide conservative books.
That's right. It's going to be
if you have a bookstore in your town. It's
anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It'll be under the, never mind. It'll be behind the counter, you know.
All right. Yeah, with the razor blades and the batteries.
Available July 6th. So get yours today, though. Get in line and order it today.
Let me just give you one interesting example of the way this phenomenon works. And,
all right.
And Michelle's the driver here. She's a dangerous lady. But lefty, if Barack, first of all, if Barack Obama had a white wife, he never would have been elected. He knew that. And people have said as much. Before the racialization becomes too prominent, Michelle has an incident where she goes, I think it must have been her first term, where she goes shopping at a Target in suburban Virginia, incognito, right?
Okay.
And she's, you know, looks like any other, you know, housewife would look, not like she, you know, like a Walmart shopper, you know, the classic. And she's on the David Letterman show, and she's telling the story. She goes, "Yeah." She goes, "Oh, it was a lot of fun." She's in a good mood, and she's saying, "No one recognized me." In fact, she goes, "One woman comes up to me, and she asked me if I could help her get something off the shelf because she's real not very tall, and I'm not tall, so I get it off the shelf for her, you know." And everyone's laughing and good time. Oh, it was a blast, you know. Well, then after the racialization starts taking place, after Ferguson, she's interviewed by they're interviewed by People magazine, both of them, as to racial incidents that that trouble them.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michelle tells the same story about the same incident in a totally different way. It's like watching Rush Homan. You know, we have different angles on a different story.
Wow.
This time, she's in this store, and she's only slightly disguised. And then one white woman, sees her, knows who she is, and doesn't care that she's the first lady, and asks her to get something off the shelf.
What?
Because she was the help. Michelle says this woman saw Michelle Obama, despite the fact that she was the first lady, as the help.
Right, okay.
This is the same incident. This is how they twist stories. This guy, I hate to say this, goes on all the time in black community, has been for a long time. You get together, you tell stories about how you've been victimized.
Right.
You know? And white people get victimized all the time, too. But in our stories, we don't have a predictable outcome. So when I get stopped for speeding, I usually say, you know, because I have Missouri license plates or the cop was a jerk or something, you know. Right. I'm never at fault. Of course not. And not in your own story, you know. I didn't really run that red light officer, you know. But in the stories that they tell, and Obama tells them too. So in the book, he talks about how he could hear the sound of doors clicking when he walked across the street in Chicago dressed in a suit, right?
Oh, my God. Okay.
This is pathetic.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
This is what he's had to do.
Oh.
He's had to darken his canvas, as one of his authors, you know, as one of his biographers says, you know, and one of his friendly biographers says. And he's encouraged all of America to do that. So if Obama's, if this is happening to Michelle Obama, you know, the first lady is being humiliated in a grocery store. Even though they know she's a first lady, they still treat her like help. This is in 2015 she's telling this story, after 7 years in the White House.
Wow.
This is why we have this divide we have today. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, well, yeah, okay. That almost drives me to that. Wow. Just thinking about that and the tweaking of that story.
And the scary thing is I'm not exaggerating at all.
No.
And the incidents are because the Letterman shows, you know, I linked to it, but the Letterman shows, you could watch it. You can see how happy and funny and the story is. It's okay. It's a cute story.
Right. Wow. Wow, folks, Jack Cashel is my in-studio guest. I'm so glad to have him in studio. You're listening to the Hagmann Report right here on the Global Star Radio Network. Before I get back to Jack, I want to tell you, folks, I'm going to tell you about Policy Genius. And I want to thank Policy Genius for being a corporate sponsor of ours, and we appreciate what they do. You know, summer started already. It's kind of hard to believe. We're halfway through 2021, and summer began. And you know what that means. It's time to save on life insurance. That way you'll have a bigger budget for summer things like pool floats and, oh, all kinds of stuff you can have fun with. And between Father's Day, Flag Day, National Yo-Yo Day, the month of June is a lot going on. Thankfully, Policy Genius makes it easy to cross life insurance off your list so you can get back to doing your thing, whatever that might be. And if you ask Eric the Tech, it's out there fishing. I know he loves to fish. But, you know, if someone relies on your financial support, and I know that us dads, as we were talking about earlier about fatherhood, us dads, and moms too, you know, whether it's a child or aging parent or even a business partner, you need life insurance. Policy Genius makes it easy to compare quotes from over a dozen top insurers all in one place. Why compare? Well, you can save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes with Policy Genius. You could save $1,300 or more per year on life insurance by using Policy Genius to compare policies. And the licensed experts at Policy Genius work for you, not the insurance company, so you can trust them to help you navigate every step of the shopping and buying process. You know, as a captive agent a lifetime ago, briefly for a company, things like this scared me because I know they could beat the price of a captive agent. Now, here's how this works. Getting started is very simple. It's easy. First, head to policygenius.com. That's policygenius.com. In minutes, you can work out how much life insurance coverage you need and compare personalized quotes to find your best price. When you're ready to apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and scheduling for free. Yeah. You don't have to pay anything. Policy Genius never sells your information to other companies, and Policy Genius doesn't add on extra fees. Now, here's what you need to do. Head to policygenius.com to get started right now. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. And in June, let's get it right halfway through the year. Again, my in-studio guest, and I'm so lucky to have in-studio guest Jack Cashel.
And an audience.
And an audience. Susan Daniels, and as I'm looking over the sea of people, I'm kidding. Susan Daniels, tremendously famous PI that really was instrumental in uncovering, as Jack said, the Connecticut Social Security number and the issue of constitutional eligibility of Barack Hussein Obama. And, you know, who is this guy? And, of course, Nin Privatera, a good friend of the show. And
now, in a minor digression, do you remember what a peanut gallery was? Do you remember the peanut gallery?
Yes, I do.
It was, which show was that?
Wait,
Susan, how do you do?
How do you do?
Right. You're, Doug's a little younger. You're, these guys are old. They remember all stuff. Except for
I just age well. Yeah.
Except for the song 16 Tons, which they don't know very well. But
wait a minute. I was 19 Tons.
I got my. It was. I was thinking about that because in one of the bizarre weekends of my life, I was. It was a New Year's Eve weekend, and my closest friend at the time was engaged to. At the time, I was living in a Newark housing project. My friend lived in a log cabin, but his girlfriend was a Westchester County, New York debutante. So the three of us were invited to spend the weekend at her parents' house. And the only other house guest they had was Buffalo Bob and his wife, Buffalo Bob from Howdy Doody.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, I was, my friend was, you know, your classic, this is 70s, 1970s. Hippie, you know, degenerate. And, but I was already, fixed on my, you know, political ideology. I was probably 21 or 22. And, Buffalo Bob and I totally hit it off. And, cause he was a total right winger, you know, so you watch Howdy Doody now, you know, this, I mean, a serious one, you know, in a good way. And, you know, he said, oh, now there's hope. I see hope for the future, Jack, blah, blah, blah. And he gave me a big signed picture of Howdy Doody to take with me.
Really? So,
and I lost it.
No.
Yeah, I did. It was a shame. I don't know how I lost it. I lost it when I was moving. You know, it was like a poster-sized picture signed of Howdy Doody.
Sure.
Now, the younger people in your audience don't know what I'm talking about, but Howdy Doody was sort of an iconic figure of my childhood.
So, right.
And that's they remind me of having a peanut gallery there. So.
Well,
that's the connection.
I get it.
Just
I get
a little,
it.
It's like a digression here.
Well, that's all right. Because what I'm going to ask you next is kind of a little bit more deep, I suppose. You had mentioned earlier about.
By the way, how can it not be more deep than that story? Sorry. Go ahead.
So I just snorted. Sorry about that. Eric the tech always gets me on me when I do that. You had mentioned something earlier, and I wanted to kind of follow up on this. In your book, you address this, and you talk about Barack Obama's identity or identity crisis, if you will, with respect to who he is. How can I put this delicately, or should I even put it delicately? You know, his manhood, I guess.
Because that comes up. And I got to give credit here to David Garrow. I mentioned David Garrow earlier.
Yep.
Boy, what a bold guy, because he's already won a Pulitzer Prize. He's clearly of the left. I'm just going to tell you what else he has done that he did last year that shocked even me, is that he's the foremost historian of Martin Luther King. And he got access to the FBI files where they had been, at Bobby Kennedy's request, monitoring, you know, and bugging his rooms, motel rooms.
Right.
And we know that he's a Flanderer, that when that's well known. But what Garrow revealed is that not only was it Flanderer, but there were group rapes going on that he was sort of participating in or encouraging. And Garrow reported this. And what he had was the FBI notes. He didn't have the tapes themselves, but the notes of the tapes. And then to the degree that the media covered this, and they covered it so remotely and discreetly, he had to go to England to get this stuff published. They said, well, these are just the notes. They're not the tapes. The tapes won't be released until 2027. He said, Do you think they would take contemporaneous notes that weren't in the tapes? You know, when J. Edgar Hoover could hear the tapes and then he sees the notes saying something different. No, it's nuts. Of course they're saying this is what they what's in the tapes.
Right.
And he said, and when Garrow came out with it, he said, we may have to rethink, especially in light of the Me Too movement, Martin Luther King's place in history. That's how bad this is.
Wow.
And I said, boy, this is a guy with nerve, right?
Yeah.
And he's also a seriously good reporter. So when I read his biography of Obama when it came out in 2017, there was a part that alluded to Obama's bisexuality or homosexuality. But it just alluded to it. One of the women who knew Obama when he was young talked about it. And then someone, actually, I'll give credit here, Charles Johnson, one of the crazy guys on the right, really crazy, if you know Charles, called me out of the blue one night. He says, get a hold of Garrow's paperback version, right? So the paperback version comes out in 2018. And in it, he has the contents of the letter that this woman redacted when she shared it with Garrow originally. Right?
Ooh.
And in the letter, we have Obama saying, writing to this girl, this is a quote, I make love to men daily in my imagination. And then he goes on to say, I'm androgynous to a large degree, and I hope to become more so. This is in the letter.
Wow.
So now I have to find out, before I can write about this, why Garrow didn't include it in the hardback, was in the paperback. I thought maybe the publisher had scotched it. So I emailed him, and he's no fan of mine, but, you know, not to be expected, because the problem with these mainstream biographers is they utterly ignore everything that people like Susan Daniels does.
Sure, sure.
I mean, whether you're true or not,
I
they don't want to know it. They just won't even. So I emailed Garrow, but he emailed me back nicely, and he said, here's what happened. When he interviewed this woman, initially she would not share with him the actual letter. She read him, you know, parts of it, but not the redacted part. But he's such a dogged reporter, she went and sold her letters to Emory University, the library. Right.
Okay.
So he went to Emory University Library, got only the original, and that's where Obama is talking about his bisexuality. This is as a 23-year-old man in 1984 who writes, "I make love to men daily in my imagination."
In my imagination.
In 1984. Now, I mean, it might be fashionable for 15-year-olds to say that, but in 1984, this was all but an admission of your sexual. Ambiguity,
yeah,
to say the least.
I was going to just add that, to say the least.
And then I went back and I watched Larry Sinclair's press conference at National Press Club.
And we've had him, you know, we've had him as a guest
is
on
the
show. Oh, yeah. Huh. Yeah, I've got his book in my library. And I've talked to Larry Sinclair on and off air.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, his story has never changed, never wavered.
Nope.
And folks, if you don't know, Listen. Go ahead.
And I went back and rewatched it. He's a little crazy, you know.
Well,
but he'd have to be to rent a room in National Press Club and talk about his assignation with Obama when he was a state senator, when he gave names, details, dates, places, phone numbers, and at the press conference, he said, I encourage you to do your work, follow up, verify what I'm saying, you know. But of course, the media didn't. In fact, what they did is not only they dox him, they knew that he had an outstanding warrant in Colorado, and they called the authorities and had him arrested.
Mm-hmm.
The media had Larry Sinclair arrested. Can you imagine them doing that to, let's say, Christine Blasey Ford or, Julie Swetnick or Stormy Daniels?
Yeah, of course.
No, when those revelations came forward, however true or false they were A, embraced, and they certainly didn't question the source, you know?
Right.
But, and now we're flirting with real homophobia, you know? I mean, to treat Larry Sinclair differently because he said it was a sexual relationship. And then he gets into the whole Donald Young story. You know?
Okay.
This is the choir director in Obama's, and
that's no longer with us in the larger sense.
That it was murdered. And, unsolved murder.
Right.
And what Sinclair said is that Young was calling him and saying, leave Obama alone. And Sinclair wasn't sure whether he meant it as politically dynamite or stay off my man, you know?
Okay.
But in any case, Young is murdered.
Yeah, I've never heard of that connection before, Jack, but go ahead.
No, so Sinclair talks about that at some length and, you know, with some clarity and mentions multiple phone calls between them. And that's why he says that he goes, I have the records to the press. Check them out, you know?
I somehow missed that. Okay. Wow. All right. So go, I mean.
And Donald Young's mother gives an interview to the Inquirer someplace and says, yeah, she thought it was because of his relationship with Obama, you know.
Oh,
and this is all, no one ever covers this. You're not even allowed to talk about it, you know. It's
I'm glad you're talking about it right now. As a matter of fact, I'm learning some things. So, but how does that work out with I mean, did that, that was in 1984 when Obama had penned that missive.
Right,
And it was to a girl, right?
Yes, a girl with whom he had some kind of relationship, but maybe, I don't know whether sexual or not. He had a couple actual literal girlfriends,
mm-hmm.
and Garrow gets into it well. I mean, this is, and one of whom was half Asian, right? And she resented being called white and his composite girlfriend, because she was the basis of the composite.
Okay.
But the two women that knew him best and had relationship with him when he was a young man and past college speak contemptuously of him, which is interesting. Even though they were in love with him, or thought they were, or whatever, and they see him as a phony and as a fraud and a sellout, and it's and maybe a part of it is bitterness at having Obama having broken off the relationships, but I think Obama broke off the relationships because he wasn't, well, for two reasons. One is that he was not sure of his own sexuality. And the other is that he started getting ambitious and he knew. Two major personal moves to ground himself in African America. And one was to join the Church of the Reverend Wright.
Right. Okay.
And the other, and to Christianize himself. And the other was to marry Michelle.
Let's talk about Michelle, if you don't mind. What does that say about Michelle Obama?
Michelle is, she's another.
Notice I said Michelle, folks.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating case. Because she had a book come out, and I talk about it in my book, her book, Becoming, which was a massive bestseller. Although I've never seen a copy in anyone's hand, you know. Have you ever seen a copy?
I have not. I haven't.
When I'm on airplanes, especially, you think people would have a book or someplace people read a book. Sold a couple million copies, and I've never seen one in the wild, you know?
And she got a ton of money in advance,
right? Oh, yeah. They got like a $70 million advance.
I think like maybe 5 more million than you got.
I would say about 69.999% million more than I did.
Right.
But my books are true, you know? I write nonfiction. She's the case. She has some of the same problems Obama does, but she's more legitimately African American. I mean, she has roots you could trace back to slaves. I mean, that's
right. Okay.
But she also grew up in a pretty comfortable home, two parent home, you know. Obama used to compare it to Leave It to Beaver and another old TV reference for those who are too young to remember. And,
Wally.
Exactly. And, she's always been insecure too, because she's, lived in a world. She went to like a magnet school where people were smart. She's a senior in high school, and she talks about this. She says that my guidance counselor, she said she wanted to go to Princeton. My guidance counselor said, you don't have good test scores or good grades. Grades good enough to get into Princeton, you know? No, I wanted to go to Princeton when I was coming out of high school.
Right.
I went to the best Catholic high school in the country.
Yeah.
Anthony Fauci's high school, for the record. And maybe reputation has taken a hit lately, but nonetheless, I could tell you I had very good grades, very good test scores. And when I talked to my guidance counselor, he said, how are you going to afford Princeton? And he was right. I couldn't. So I didn't apply.
Wow.
Michelle Obama's guidance counselor said, you can't get in with these kind of test scores. She got in, right? And then okay. she gets into Harvard Law School. I read her master's thesis. I'm sorry, her Princeton senior thesis. And as Christopher Hitchens said, it was written in no known language. So I miss Christopher Hitchens, who was not afraid to say those things. And he was the first one to offer the thesis that it was Michelle who was pulling Barack Obama back into the hood. I mean, to the mental hood.
You know? Yeah, I get that. And I can see that.
Yeah. And the one who was whispering in his ear, like, do we have to salute? I mean, that kind of
right,
thing.
You know? Right, right.
So, for instance, in his promise book, Promised Land, Obama makes a big deal about the flag pin episode.
Yeah. Okay.
And Michelle is always the one who's telling about the Tea Party, this, and the racism of this, and the racism of that. So she's at Princeton. She's so over her head. She should never be at Princeton. Both of them rode the affirmative action gravy train all their lives. And from Obama's case, from Punahou in Hawaii, the prep school, yeah. all the way through Harvard. He admits it much at a couple times, a couple honest moments in his life. He'll admit as much. Michelle never admits that. Hmm. She gets in and she shows that she could succeed because they can't fail her. They can't not let her succeed once she gets in. And, you know, she works hard and makes half an effort. And at Harvard, I knew guys who went to Harvard at the same time Obama did. And they'll tell you, they said when they saw, when the professors saw, even if they were blindly graded, when they saw a test that was so far below the level they expected, yeah. and it was an affirmative action one, and they passed it on, you know. And so
wow.
Their whole story has been a life of privilege, both of them, both of unearned privilege.
Yeah.
And they have to – and what CRT does is it justifies in their own minds their deserving that privilege. It justifies their earning that privilege because it tells them that there's systemic racism all the way through and you've overcome it, you know?
Let me think about that. There's systemic racism and you've overcome it. All right.
Because, you see, it denies what it denies to the – there are black people out there today who don't know that for the last 50-some years that people at the level of the Obamas who could – had the wherewithal to even apply to a law school or to a college like Princeton, had been getting a golden key, a golden pass all the way through. They don't know that. They think they've been told this over, and they're still being told this, that corporations, universities discriminate against them, work against them, trying to suppress them, when the absolute opposite has been true for 50 years, and they've been denied that information.
Right. Right. Okay.
It doesn't work on the street level. I mean, if you're working at McDonald's, it doesn't matter what color you are.
Yeah.
But if you're applying to Harvard, it absolutely does.
I get that. Okay. Wow. Wow. So, okay. What else? Well, this critical race theory that you reference. I mean, what more should we just say about this? Because this is really so divisive. Critical race theory. I don't know if it's the most divisive issue contemporaneous to. I don't even know what to ask, Jack.
No, well, domestically, it is the most divisive issue. It's the one issue that is corroding America in ways that is entirely unnecessary, and we have this gentleman to thank for it. In the book, I document how we got there, but yeah. It didn't have to happen. I mean, it's a domestic problem we don't have to have. And the net result of it is, and this we can talk about because it leads into it, even though I don't get into it in the book. I've written a lot about it, into what's going to happen on Friday when they sentence Derek
Chauvin. Oh, yes. Yeah, let's please talk about this because it's Friday, folks. It's coming. Go ahead.
And I've been writing about this, and I watched the trial.
Yep.
What dismayed me. And, in fact, Nin and I were talking about this on the way down, how the right has, you know, the media, right, conservative media, many of our politicians are afraid of this issue, just like they're afraid of the January 6th issue. You know, these guys are rotting in Washington prisons and
450 of them are.
And our people aren't even, don't want to talk about it.
Of course not.
Well, they sure as hell don't want to talk about Derek Chauvin.
Right.
And they're willing to let those four cops fry for fear of seeming on the wrong side of history. But if you've watched the trial, if you followed the case closely, Chauvin shouldn't even been arrested. None of them should have. And he's looking at 30 years in prison. That's what the prosecution's asking. And that's likely the judge will give him at least half of that. I just let me walk through that case because those people don't know what happened.
Please.
Chauvin is, I believe, a 19-year veteran. He gets a call. He's the second car on the case. And the case of his partner, Tuo Tao, is even, in a sense, more poignant.
That was a police officer across the street, right?
No, Tao was in his car. He came with Chauvin. There was another Asian police officer. Who was a park police officer across the street.
Okay, that's right.
Who was monitoring the scene.
Okay.
He did not get arrested. The four officers who get arrested, you have the two rookie cops who get to the scene first. They've both been on the beat a week and are in the same car. I don't get that, but that's what happened. Right. One of them has a Nigerian father, you know, not exactly. Well, the Nigerians were the ones. Let me take that back. Jussie Smollett was the white supremacist who attacked Jussie Smollett. were Nigerian, so maybe he was a white supremacist from Nigeria. No, but it's.
You can't make this up.
One, no, right. The one guy's white. The other guy is a Nigerian father. He's, you know, half black like Obama. He's black. He's not biracial. Obama's not biracial. And with Chauvin's car is he and Tuo Tao, whose parents fled communist in Cambodia, only to find them running the streets of Minneapolis. So the cops can't get Floyd to stay in the police car. The second car is called. That's when Chauvin arrives. He's the senior officer on the scene. So he says, he's charged with particular cruelty. The judge and the judges and asking for enhanced punishment.
Right.
Particular cruelty. He comes on the scene and he sees them struggling and he doesn't take out his taser. He doesn't take out his nightstick. He could have both legal. Yeah. He says, can we turn on the air conditioning for you, George? Right? I already know his name. You know.
Yeah.
And how about if we roll down the windows? He goes, because I'm claustrophobic. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
Right.
He's saying, I can't breathe. He's in the back of the car. George Floyd is at the time his autopsy 6'4", 223, and he's muscular.
Yep.
Chauvin maybe weighs 160 pounds soaking wet, and he's the biggest of the four. And so then finally said, Floyd wants to get out of the car. He's fighting to get out of the back of the police car. He said, I can't breathe. And then when Chauvin says, well, how about if we turn the air conditioner, blah, blah, blah. No. So when they let him out of the car onto the ground, he goes, thank you for letting me out. Thank you for letting me out,
right.
You know, for putting me on the ground. Thank you. He's thanking them, right? And he's intermittently saying, I can't breathe. Now, the maneuver that Chauvin uses to keep him under control, because he's flopping all around and he's huge. He's a big, strong guy. I just happened to see my office is in my office in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's in the hip part of town. And I was calling it WAZ for the Westport Autonomous Zone, the neighborhood's called Westport. But then when they went to the Capitol Hill occupied protest, CHOP, I couldn't call my area WAP because I'm getting arrested for a hate crime. Sorry, Nin, but Nin understands. And but anyhow. It's on a kind of semi-major street. I hear the screaming one day. I go outside. This is about a week before the George Floyd incident. And I get outside and I see a cop doing exactly the same thing that Chauvin did to a woman. Right?
Okay.
And my first thought, thank God she's white, you know? Big woman, struggling violently. And he had her under control. All he had to use was one knee on her neck shoulder area.
Right.
And she was screaming. For about 10 minutes, because he had to wait for backup. And I didn't know what provoked it. And I was going to take out my phone. I wish I had in retrospect, just so I could show it as a show you this is standard operating procedure.
Yep.
But I didn't want to make him nervous, you know. Cops have enough issues. And then the backup coming, they put like a Hannibal the Cannibal mask over her. So she was probably biting or doing something. And then they haul her off. Took several people, but she's, you know, a big woman, but she's not 6'4", 223 pounds. So they have him on the street. Now, he's saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. But he's been saying that in a police car. And they didn't know that. The onlookers didn't know that. So they start screaming at the cops, you know.
Right.
And not only screaming, but threatening. So Tao, I just call him Tao, has to go around and protect the officers who are suppressing Floyd from the crowd.
Right.
That's all he does. He's looking at 30 years in prison for that, right?
For enabling a
second-degree murder. He won't get 30 years, but he's looking at serious prison time.
All right.
So, meanwhile, the three officers are holding Floyd down, and they call for an ambulance, and then they realize he's in distress. They don't know why exactly. They think he's totally drugged out with good reason. And then they up the ante on the emergency call. We need to call a car here pronto.
Right.
In 9 minutes, we have the famous 9 minutes. By the time they get there, et cetera, and they take him away. And then when they get there, they don't administer first aid on the scene, CPR, because it seems too violent, too threatening.
Right.
So they take him away a few more blocks where he's finally, you know, and then they take him to the hospital. That's what happens. So when did this guy deserve a 30-year prison sentence? What did he do? He thought, he knows there's cameras on him, you know.
Right.
And in all of the proceedings, there's no mention of his motive. What's your motive? You know, there should be a motive for the crime. Why does he get 30 years in prison for, why did he kill this guy? He thought he was doing the right thing. At one point in the proceedings, the other officer says, he may have that excited delirium thing, think we should put him on his side. And then Chauvin says, no, this is why we have him in this position. He goes, that's why we have him in this position. Chauvin is thinking this is the better position.
Right.
To control that, you know, so he's not exerting himself and going crazy. And now he's facing 30 years in prison because of this guy. Going back to the Henry Louis Gates incident that I was talking about earlier. Cops acting stupidly.
Right.
And it kept amping up, and now they're murderers, right? And then we had $2 billion worth of damage, and we're supposed to get a fair trial in Minneapolis.
It ain't gonna happen.
It didn't happen.
Never happened.
And so now, and this is what distresses me, and I'd say this to your audience, is that too many conservatives have been too quiet about this. They don't even want to know about it. They want it to go away. They're willing to sacrifice Chauvin and the other cops and hope that the bad stuff goes away.
You know? See, okay, so all of this, everything that you've talked about is pretty much addressed in your new book coming out the 6th. So we can almost, I don't want to put all the blame on Barack Hussein, Satoru Obama, or whatever. But,
accomplices.
Yeah.
But the net result is, and this, I say this to African Americans particularly, they know it, is that it results in several thousand more blacks being killed every year than the trend line was when Obama took the presidency. This past year, we've had murder rate jump back post Minneapolis. The numbers have gone through the roof.
What? Maybe this is an unfair question. What do you think this country would look like if anybody but Barack Hussein Obama would have been in that office for 8 years?
It would probably look like what it did between 2001 and 2008. Mm. In fact, our high water mark on national collegiality or whatever, solidarity, came after September 11th.
Yeah.
Where, unless maybe you were a Muslim terrorist, everyone looked at each other like we're all in this together.
Right.
You know? And that, that feeling of goodwill didn't fray immediately. But there was no racial incident between 2001 and 2008 that was divisive. You know, there was no Trayvon Martin case, there was no Ferguson, you know?
Yeah.
That all happened on Obama's watch. We would probably be back. We would probably have a much more harmonious nation. There's no doubt about it. There'd be thousands more black people alive than are alive today because they've been, so many of the murders are intraracial. The great majority of them are within the race. And, I'll give you in Kansas City, for instance, before Ferguson, the year before, we had 76 murders.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, we had 182. Our homicide rate is 30 times higher than in the neighboring suburban communities, you know?
Wow.
And there's, and I can tell you this from my own knowledge, there's a whole lot more guns on our side than on their side.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And a lot more people know how to use them, you know?
And okay, so was that the intent of Barack Obama's, I mean, Barack Obama's promised land? That song, the Rose Garden, he didn't promise.
I never promised you a Rose Garden. Yeah, okay. Yeah, right.
Anyway, as a community organizer, and then of course, president, and I say president hesitantly, but okay, ostensibly, he was president, but this wasn't his intent, was it? I mean, is it possible?
No, I don't think it was intent. But he was the kind of guy who led from behind, right?
Oh,
that was that's their own phrase when you're talking about Libya.
Yeah.
Leading from behind. He's been leading from behind all his life. He's leading from behind right now. And just to get back to the Bob Bauer story. And,
yes.
Well, Bauer, you know, after they retrieved the birth certificate, and I would just say this, anyone capable of dumbing up the Steele dossier is incapable of dumbing up a birth certificate.
Absolutely.
Bauer's wife, Anita Dunn, runs Joe Biden's campaign. She's the one who runs his campaign.
And Anita Dunn is married to
Bob Bauer.
Bob Bauer. Okay. Sorry about that. I was going somewhere else, but yes.
They're the golden couple behind Biden's ascendancy.
Right.
A month before Biden announces, Bauer writes this total hit piece in the Atlantic, scoring Donald Trump as a racist. Just a violent, ugly article, right?
Okay.
And based on the Charlottesville lie, you know, that where Trump is alleged to have said that there are good people on both sides without elaborating. And so then a month later when Biden announces for presidency, he announces he's running because of Charlottesville, right? So the racial divide is now firmly fixed in place. And it's based on false information, just like it's been based on false information all along.
Right.
I mean, the news media for 72-hour cycle fell for Jesse Smollett. That's how, and some of them probably still believe
still
it.
Do. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But that became normative kind of reporting. The look, the search, the hunt for the great white, violator of civil rights.
Right.
And Derek Chauvin, you know, George Zimmerman, you know, Darren Wilson in Ferguson. You know, the hunt is on all the time, you know, for that model that they could use on the media and beat over your head with, and then the Democrats can demagogue. Well, Obama started it. Biden is clumsy. Oh, he's terribly clumsy at it. He doesn't even know how to do it, but he's been doing it ham-handedly ever since he started running, and he's aggravated the pressure. So for him, you know, George Floyd was a godsend. And if it wasn't George Floyd, it would have been someone else. That
someone else. Yep. I believe that. And now we're at, you know, the BLM Marxist, obviously the organization. BLM is a Marxist organization. We're at defund the police everywhere. We're having critical race theory pushed upon our children. It just doesn't seem like it was a very successful 8 years for Barack.
Maybe for Barack. I mean, look at him. Look where he lives.
Well, you know, right? Yeah.
Here we are in the Rust Belt Riviera. We're looking at the $12 million house on Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
That's not really his house, but it's just representative.
You know, yeah, it's just, okay. It is mind-blowing.
The other thing other than race that he's most triggered by in his memoir, Promised Land?
Yeah.
The environment. The global climate change, right?
Okay. All right. Well, let's discuss that.
It is mind-boggling. I mean, hypocrisy doesn't cover this waterfront, no pun intended. If you recall, and you know, we know certain things that the other side forgets. We remember because it's come a punchline, is that when he secured the nomination in 2008. He goes, this is the moment the oceans stopped to rise and all that, you know. And after he buys his house, the pundits were saying, well, I guess he succeeded on that front.
Yeah.
He's got an oceanfront house. He's not worried. In his memoir, A Promised Land, he draws these like apocalyptic pictures of a devastated earth, people wandering. He's worried about Malia and Sasha and them living in these wastelands and all this sort of. And he seems to, it's like a religion for him now. It's like he's leading from behind again. He has to get on this bandwagon, you know. When he was running, you know, it was always part of the package, the larger intersectional package of Democratic issues, these various groups coming together, Brown Front, Black Front, Green Front, you know, Pink Front, Rainbow Front, you know, all these various groups. But on the two that he's most keen on is the Black issues and Green issues. And then he goes out with his the multi-millions he and Michelle actually did earn, finally, because they sold a lot of books, and buys a $12 million beachfront house. What does that tell us? I mean, it's three times the size of a normal home. So just the power of the house is, you know, consuming a ton of electricity, et cetera. And it's on the beach. Are we worried about rising oceans anymore?
Apparently not. Or a carbon footprint.
Yeah. Or a carbon footprint,
yeah.
Neither.
Yeah.
Let alone income inequality.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's in your face. It's like,
yeah, yeah. All right.
And it's sort of like the response of the left to when Patricia Cullors, the BLM founder, buys her $1.4 million California home.
One of four, though, right?
Right, one of four. Yeah. And then the response from the left was, what, are you trying to deny Black people their due, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, aren't they entitled to rewards of the system, too? Well, if you're a professed Marxist, or in Obama's case, a crypto-Marxist, we are, you know?
A crypto-Marxist. Is that kind of a wouldn't that be a globalist, if you will?
Yeah, that's it, perfectly. And what's interesting in the book is that Obama identifies, he makes fun of liberals, like the Prius driving,
right,
latte drinking liberals of San Francisco, who got him into trouble because he told them about the Pennsylvanians who were clinging, and you take personal insult at that one, clinging to their God and their guns.
Yep.
And he talks about that in the book. He talks about progressives in his memoir as a them, not as a us, not as a me. Progressives are always badgering him to do this, to do that, to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that. He hates centrists, that he makes no affiliation with them. But internationalists, that's his ticket. And he doesn't use the word globalist. He uses the word internationalist.
Internationalist.
Because globalist is, you know, they know that we use the word, like we use the word woke. They probably so regret having introduced the word woke into the vocabulary, because we have much more fun with it than they do. And it's so much easier to say woke than progressive. You know?
Right, right. So the man, Barack Hussein Obama, the author of Promised Land, and of course, Jack Cashel, the author of Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply, available July 6th. There it is on your screen. If you're listening to this by radio, just come back and watch this on video. But go to Amazon, and get a copy. Order a copy today. Please do that, because I'm going to be, like I said, bumper locking Jack Cashel for the next hour and 15 minutes and grabbing a copy of his book. But myself, because advanced copy. But seriously, what I know from the book and of what it contains, it really fills in a lot of the blanks that you need to know about. And Jack's a great investigative researcher, author, and writer, and an all-around good guy. So Pulitzer Prize winner twice, I think, on I'm joking. But
yeah, right, Pulitzer's. In 2018, the New York Times and the Washington Post shared a Pulitzer for their reporting on the Russia collusion.
Isn't that...
This is 2018.
What do you say to
By
that?
By then, you and I knew this was a joke, and we'd known it was a joke for 2 years.
I can't even form the words to, yeah, okay.
And, you know, what's interesting, too, is I wrote an article about this, and I'm going to boast a little bit. I have American Spectator puts out the articles, most read articles of the month.
I saw that.
I got one and two.
Yeah.
This month. So the one article that got the most attention was an article called The Obama Team's Delusional Take on the Russia Hoax.
Right.
And it's based on a book by Edward DeVere is his last, Edward Isaac DeVere. And it's actually as a campaign book. It's a book about the 2020 campaign. He gets the Democratic. He's got insiders talking to him, which is useful, by the way, to any like aspiring pundits out there to read the other people's stuff. Because he gets to interview Susan Rice, the national security advisor under Obama. Was she Secretary of State?
Susan Rice?
She was certainly national security advisor.
National security advisor.
Yep. And John Brennan, who was the CIA director.
And his national security advisor during the campaign.
Yeah, right. But,
yeah.
There's a piece of work. But
which goes back to the passport breaking passport
yeah,
office
right,
and all
exactly,
that stuff.
Right,
yeah,
right, to, totally.
Yeah.
And their take on the – they don't acknowledge there was a hoax. They believe – you know, and Susan Rice tells them, well, we were vindicated by the Mueller report, you know.
Vindicated.
That's the word they use, and they explain it. Here's what happens: the way they explain it, it's Brennan is telling DeVere, and DeVere is like a stenographer here. You know, just taking him at his word, and he's saying that you know we got information in the summer of 2016 that they were going to hack our elections up and down the across the country. You know. And then what happened in their retelling of the story, which is so fanciful, I was laughing out loud when I'm reading it. Obama meets Putin in September in China at some G7 summit or whatever. And then, as he tells it, Obama staring down from his masterful 6'1" height at the 5'7" Putin. You know, Putin could kick his butt in a minute. It's like, but not that I'm rooting for Russia, but you know, it's just reality. He said, listen, you stay out of this, blah, 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 blah. And then Brennan says, and here's what I imagine Putin took away. Listen, maybe we'd get in real trouble if we mess with the technical details of the election. So maybe we'll just do go to propaganda. We'll just do propaganda stuff.
Okay.
So that covers everything now because we're not allowed to say that a foreign entity might have mixed with the 2020 election, but they could say it about the 2016 election. And then as early as December 2016, Obama was saying, yeah, we scared them out of mixing with our election.
Right.
Because I talked to them, blah, blah, blah. And then they just did the propaganda. Well, the Russians didn't need to do propaganda. CNN, MSNBC, ABC, NBC, CBS, New York Times, Washington Post have been doing all the possible propaganda they could possibly do for 4 years. And what they weren't doing, they were being reinforced by, you know, Google, you know, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. It was a total media propaganda show for 4 years. And what could Russia possibly have added to that? And so they justified their intrusion into the, you know, basically the Trump campaign by saying that Russia was intent on jimmying the actual election results up and down the coast. It's amazing that they get away with this stuff, or they think they do. They live in a delusional land. And that's why I wrote this book, because I did not want fake news to become fake history. I wanted them to have at least one milestone that said, here's what really happened during the Obama presidency.
That's a pretty profound statement, I think. You didn't want fake news to become fake history. And I think that's a problem, a huge problem that we face today. Which, folks, that's why I would urge everyone to go right now and get yourself a copy, advanced order. It's coming out the 6th of July, of Barack Obama's Promised Land, Deplorables Need Not Apply, by Jack Cashel, the same guy who wrote the book, TWA 800, and Unmasking Obama, The Hunt, a great book of one of my favorites, and many others. And, of course, a writer for numerous publications and an all-around great guy, and here he is with me. But this book in particular is going to be the one that really kind of puts the crown on the, I don't know, the icing on the cake, whatever metaphor you want to use. But I think this is going to be the ultimate, in my view, the ultimate about what happened to some extent, how Obama really misrepresented. He lied. He twisted history.
And yeah, you know, it's really a tragedy, too, on the Back to the Fatherhood front.
Yeah, please.
Now, I'm going to give him credit. He's a good father. They were good parents, you know?
Okay.
The book is a pay-on. I mean, there's a lot in the book about his family. It is a pay-on to the joys of fatherhood, right? He understands that, you know, especially since he didn't have a father himself.
Right, right.
And he knew that. He knew the value of fatherhood. And then he was scared off that track by Jesse Jackson early in his presidency.
Yeah, that kind of sticks in my mind, the influence that Jackson had on Obama. But I guess I could see that. And then, of course,
it's not just Jackson was representing authentic African American left.
Yes.
And that yes. scared the bejesus out of Obama from the beginning.
Right. Right. And I can see that.
And he's still scared of him, you know?
Man.
Even from his lofty perch, even from his meddling presence in the running of the White House. Now, there's many competing forces trying to fill that void, and we know that, but he's clearly one of them. He and his people are one of them.
See, when I think of the 2020, I just have to toss this in. Eric the Tech, how much time do we have left on our program clock? How many?
4 minutes
left. When I think about the 2020 election, Obama is kind of up there in terms of, in my view anyway, in terms of people who are, at least he's got a lot of input into. You got Biden is Obama 2.0 in some respects, in many respects. But I digress. Since we only have a few minutes left, take us to close us out.
Okay, I'm going to give you one last secret.
Okay.
I think I know what they were trying to hide on the birth certificate.
Oh.
Should I save that for the book?
You want to come over? No, 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 please.
I don't think it was the where.
Okay.
I think it was the when.
The when?
The when. And this is where, you know, this is like, I'm taking one for the team, guys. I have to read all these other bios that the left puts out and the media puts
sure.
out. And I have to read all the other stuff on Obama. I mean, it's really painful, but it's part of a labor of love, you know. All the major biographers of Obama, including the ones of his mother and his father, and there's now we're talking five or six by Pulitzer Prize winning big time authors, talk about the Obama move to Hawaii in 1960. We have a wild child. That's Ann Dunham, the mom.
Right.
We know that she has an affection for men of color. Even she's told Obama about this. And, you know, she was enthralled by the movie Black Orpheus when she was 16-year-old. She's run away from home a couple times, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, in the summer of 1960, and all the authors acknowledge this, none of them gives a credible reason why, mother, father quit their jobs, and they moved the whole family away from Seattle.
Okay.
I think she's pregnant when she moves. I think she left the mainland pregnant.
Oh, okay.
Now, why would you have to hide that? Well, first of all, what you do is you're creating a legend for Obama, not because he's a future president, because you want him to have a legitimacy. You know, as
right.
In 1960, if you got pregnant, you left town. Often, you know, you went to live with your aunt in Wisconsin.
Right? Under those circumstances.
Even if the father was white. If the father is black, in 1960, there's only one state in the union where you could go and raise a multiracial child with minimum interference.
Okay.
And that's Hawaii.
Right.
The mother quits her job in the bank. She's the grandmother. She's the steadiest person in the family. The father still says he's going after new opportunities in retail furniture sales, you know. And they end up, they find the guy who's willing to put his name on it because he needs his INS status updated, right, with a American wife, right?
Okay, and that takes you to the who, though.
The who.
Okay.
And they're supposed to say the baby's born in October.
Yeah.
It blows the entire story that Obama ran for the presidency on. His entire story. I'm the product of a goat herder from Kenya and a Baba, improbable love, come together, raise me. For my father had to leave when I was two to go to Harvard. We know now that they never lived under the same roof. We know even the leftists acknowledge that. The left is coming to grips with the fact that the ones who care know that Obama spent the first year of his life in Seattle. He would have had to arrive when he was 3 weeks old to fit that chronology. No, it's the when. Doug, I can't believe this took 2 hours.
I love this. Folks, you're going to have to get the book. You're going to have to get it to get the rest of the story. That just blew my mind. Barack Obama's Promised Land. Deplorables need not apply. Jack Cashel in studio. May God bless you, Jack. Thank you so very much. Susan Daniels, an improviser. God bless. Good night, everyone.